So welcome back. I thought the course was a bit too theoretical, so I want to make it more practical. I have the assumption that most of you don't do your homework, so I think we should spend some time in class doing the homework. So what I want to do for today are three things. One, go through the homework, either do it online or let one of you present if you have it. Second, I want to show how to use GitHub and automated testing, how to write a module, a bit of software engineering, because even for the homework problems, that would already be a good way of doing that. And if you do something yourself that's more than larger than just a few functions, then it's very natural to write a package, a module for that, and store it on GitHub than just locally. And third, I wanted to talk about performance. There was quite some interest in that. Just some simple tools, what to look out, some simple chat doors, whatever the English word is. Something simple things that you need to be aware of to write fast code, and how to examine code, whether that's fast or not. So let's begin with homework. Who wants to present the first homework assignment? Crickets. If none of you wants to present, I of course didn't do the homework myself either, then we can develop a package ourselves. Should we do that? Okay.
Yes, let's do that.
Looking forward to your input. So let's do that in the usual way. Here is my Julia folder. Let's go there. And let's call it Quaternions. And let's begin by defining a type and some functions. So in principle, this should be a module. But since we haven't talked about that yet, I'm just going to do it here in the workshop ahead. Let's begin a type. Or should we really do quaternions multiplicate? I don't even know the multiplication rules.
If we want to use tests, you should use base tests.
Yes, in the beginning, no, I'm just going to...
Before you define, okay, sure.
Not the order.
I want to import all the other stuff, like the multiplication.
Yeah, I'll do that. I'll do that one by one. So, quaternion. So, it's customary in Julia that...
There's a typo.
Oh my god. Thank you. Yeah. It's customary in Julia that modules have a plural name, so quaternions. Type would be singular, but you still write it in uppercase, quaternion, and functions have lowercase names. That's just customary. Of course, you can do any way you want.
Should the parameterized type be a number, since we don't want to be adding and subtracting, say, computers or something, or cars?
Is it like that?
Yes.
Should maybe bricks?
Pardon?
Like, if this is going to be the type of the four components, then they should be bricks. Complex.
But you can have a quaternion of integers, for example.
Integers.
Quaternions can be constructed as a field over any other field.
But integers count as reals.
That's true.
Okay. I think the only thing that we're going to need is that we can add them, subtract them, and multiply them. And I think that's what you expect from numbers. So I'm going to keep that number. If we can change that later. Do you want real?
No. Yeah. Can you remind me of what that expression means? What's the T?
Okay. So that means there's a type quaternion. It has one parameter T, and that T must be a subtype of number. Let's make it real to keep it simple here. And the resulting type quaternion will be a subtype of number. And I hope I'm getting the syntax right, because we'll see. Well, this is online. So then we need to define fields. What should we use for the names?
R-I-J-K.
So R is of type T. So we can write the type like this. And should we define a constructor or not? I think the default constructor is fine at the moment. Good. So this defines the type, and the type has four fields, and the fields are called I-J-K, R-I-J-K, and they all have the same type T. And we can now play with that. For example, quaternion. Let's see whether it works. That looks good enough. That should be a real number. Let's define some... Should we have a nice way to write quaternions to output them?
Yes, that sounds good.
Let's begin with that, okay. So for that, you import base.show, and then you overload the function show, and show takes two parameters. I think the first is IO, which is the stream on which you output something, and the second is the quaternion. And I'm not using any parameter here because I want to accept any quaternion. I don't care about the type parameter PM. I don't use that here. And then how do we output that? Oof. Do you call show?
I think. Parameter in there.
Pardon?
You need to give the second parameter of show in there.
Thank you. Yes. What should we call it?
Q. Yeah, it's easy.
Very good. And then let's output something. Oof. Let's call it. No, how put you up with them? Okay, we output q.r. Okay, I'm going to put everything into a string, then it looks nice. Then we output q.r plus q.ii. If you remember the syntax, everything after the percent is just a bit small. You can't really read that. Let me increase that. It's a dollar sign, not a percent sign. Man, I was doing Python programming over the weekend. That really. There, looks much better now. So everything in the parentheses after the dollar is the expression that is output. So this gets q.r, q.i, and I just add an I after the I component.
You must have been programming for old Python. The percent syntax hasn't been used for a long time.
Really?
Yes.
What do you use these days?
I use brackets and a dot format call at the end of the string.
Really? Okay. Yeah, I never learned that. I learned Julia instead of Python. But anyway, yes?
So, Eric, I'm assuming that, obviously show was defined in you're importing show?
Yes. So the way this happens is that print is an overloaded function. And whenever you call print, it looks at whatever you want to output. And it tries to output them by calling a function that is called show. And show takes two arguments. The first is the channel where it should be output. And print by default shows to standard out.
So are you saying, how are we going to use this definition of show? Through print afterwards?
Yes.
Okay, so we won't call show.
You can call show, but you shouldn't. New definition show is ambiguous to fix define show before. Okay, what is wrong? Okay, the import syntax was wrong. I said import base.show, but the real syntax is import base, because base is the module, the base module colon, and then a comma separated list of functions that we want to import. And then.
So if somebody had already defined show for quaternion, I mean, if somewhere in the code, so somewhere in base, this had already been defined in another way,
yes.
We would be changing that definition?
You would be overwriting that definition, yes.
But show is probably not defined yet for quaternion.
Exactly. So show needs to be defined for all the types that you want to work it from. It's similar to the add operator or something. And
Eric, can you explain?
Oh, we're already also, yes?
Between the colon and the dot, for import base colon, the show, and then base dot show, because when I did this, I used import base dot function, and whenever it gave me an ambiguity error, I was
nope, import base.show, I don't know why it didn't work. I think it should have worked. I don't know what that error was. Mm.
Okay. Yeah, I was able to resolve all those ambiguity errors whenever they showed up by appropriately parameterizing or ordering my definitions.
Okay. But now it doesn't work. You see, we're getting the default version of quaternion.
Is there a difference
maybe
between,
even actually fix the error, it just only shows it once?
Yeah, that could be. Is there a difference between print and print line?
Print line just adds a new line at the
end. Sure, but with respect to this.
No, it isn't. Yeah, I hate that, because that is a trivial thing, and now I don't know how to fix it, and I'm standing here in front of all of you. More ideas, please?
If you restart the kernel, it'll give you error messages again.
Okay, restart the kernel. And run all cells. Oh, main.quaternion is because there is already a type called quaternion.
Yeah.
Is that the reason?
No. It's because you didn't give a type to the first argument, and so technically the one that takes base IO and then any is just as specific as your one.
Thank you. Thank you. Exactly. That was the reason. The first argument to show needs to be of this type IO. And what I defined is a show function that handles any first argument. And there's a fallback function in base that handles any second argument. And then these two functions, none of these two was more specific than the other, as you said.
Okay, so for those who didn't understand that but don't want to understand it, we just type in show IO.
Yes,
IO.
:: IO for the first argument is necessary.
And that's it.
And that's it,
okay.
Yes. So now we run that one here, and but output that. What? No!
Okay, what did you expect?
I expected, there you go. It is not used with print, it's just if you output it like this. Very strange.
Maybe that's what show does for you, no?
Maybe print converts to a string
I thought the default way of that would be the usual way. Okay, I'm sorry about this misunderstanding. I'm sure that can be solved by looking at the documentation for 2 or 5 minutes, but I'm not going to do that because I didn't want to, I want to talk here about types and overloading operations and so on, and not about IO. You can discuss it next work, or I can pose it as a homework problem. So this is the output I expected.
I mean, I think that's the output. That's the intuitive thing you want, right? If you want in the interpreter, it's supposed to look nice, but if you tell it to print something, you shouldn't. It may be like a debug statement or something, so you don't want it to look nice.
Yeah, that does. That's probably another way of showing something. Anyway, let's overload adding and subtracting quaternions as well. So these three operations, and I think that is correct. Actually, it here, and then we have okay. Now we need parameterize it on a type T. So this is a function called plus parameterize on a type T, because plus of course takes two quaternions as input, and I want both of them to have the same type. Actually, do I?
Yes,
I do probably. And then I have one quaternion Q1. Okay, let's make it a function because it's a bit longer. And then we return quaternion of type T. And the first argument is Q1.R plus Q2.R. Oh man, this is now cumbersome. Okay, let's try it. Let's define quaternions P equals. Let's just use the same one here. And another one. Yeah, that's what you'd expect. We can continue the example with adding subtraction, which is of course the same as adding number, quite boring. And with multiplication. Multiplication is probably horrible because you have to do all the multiplication rules, but I don't think we learn anything from that.
Go ahead, Kifre. I'll say after.
So your definition of plus for quaternions, assume that the two quaternions are of the same type, is that right?
Yes.
And why is that? Is that something you wanted to do or something you were forced?
It is customary to do that. In C++, for example, it would be different. In C++, you would define functions and they are as generic as possible except in the input. And in Julia, it's rather customary to define the add functions only for very specific types and then define promotion rules. And promotion is type conversion, where you have, say, a quaternion of single and one of double precision. Then you say the common type is double precision. Then you convert all the inputs to double precision, and then you perform the addition there.
But that's not something you would define or instruct to do here?
This is something you would add. You would now define a promotion rule for quaternions saying how they should be defined.
But it would be attached to the class operator?
No, it would be attached to the class. It would be used for everything.
I see.
Is it? Would it?
Promotion is just a function. Like
yes, another. But I don't think it's attached to the plus operator. So
no.
It would be used for everything. So in C++, the plus operation takes two arguments that you add. In Julia, the plus operation can take an arbitrary number of arguments. I have not implemented that here. But in principle, I should also implement a plus operation that takes only one quaternion. This is just a whatever positive sign, nothing changes. Return the same. And I should with arbitrary many arguments. I also didn't want to do that here, because it makes the example more complicated. I didn't ask for it in the homework. But all the other plus operations for complex numbers and so on, they handle that arbitrary many arguments.
But presumably, if I want to sum three quaternions, P plus Q plus R, when I write P plus Q plus R, it will go and call this function twice or not?
You have to do that yourself if you want
to
do
that. Or you have to do that yourself?
Yes. So if you have two an expression with two P plus P plus P, this should be... No, it works. Okay, very good. There must be some magical one that I don't understand.
It goes from left to right or from right to left. I mean, it's like the binary version.
It's because you defined it as a number, so it knows if it has...
Oh, there's a fallback operation.
Yes.
Okay, yes.
What is that?
So basically because there's a function, the way he was describing, that takes any number of arguments of numbers, and... What it does is it calls the two argument plus, which is what you'd expect. So it's smart enough to know what to do.
Okay, but it's wrong for you. So for any class that you introduce, you just define the binary plus and
you can do that if
yeah.
you want, yes. So here's the difference between how add and subtract works. So this is just a string, and the parse operation returns the internal representation of how it gets to Julia, just how the text is interpreted before it's actually evaluated. And you see, if you add numbers, then the result is, the colon is just the quote thing, everything is at the same level. There's one set of parentheses, so this corresponds to one function call, to the plus function, with three arguments. And if you subtract numbers, then it's different. Because addition, of course, is commutative and subtraction is not. So the rules, the parsing rules with Julia are actually different. If you subtract numbers, these are two function calls. The first arguments are subtracted. And then there's another function call for where the third argument is handled. So this is, though, if you divide or if you have the minus sign, then it is always handled operator by operator. For subtraction and for division, you only define binary operations. But for addition and multiplication, there can be arbitrarily many numbers, arbitrarily many arguments. Now, for quaternions and so on, this is not really relevant. But I assume for matrices, for matrix multiplication, this is actually relevant. Because then you see the whole input at the same time and can, in principle, provide an efficient operation of adding multiple matrices without allocating intermediate storage. Or when you multiply matrices, then you can use associativity to choose a better order of evaluating than left to right. I think that was the real reason to do that. And promotion rules. I know there's a section documentation that describes how you promote quaternions, but I don't recall exactly how to do that. Should we spend 2 minutes looking for that in the documentation, or do you want to go on to the next homework? Let's just do that. Why not? The documentation is easy enough to use. So here and
by the
look
way,
for promotion.
On the homework.
Okay, very good.
Sorry for coming late.
No problem. Mm. Conversion. So we can define conversion operators for different quaternions, for quaternion in a single position to quaternion in a double position. I haven't done that here. And promotion. Okay, let me give the example of how this works. So if you say promote, this is an integer and a real number, so a floating point number. They get converted to floating point numbers. And I also can have a rational number here that get also promoted to floating point numbers. But if I just have an integer and a rational number, then both is converted to a rational number as you expect. If I add a complex number in there and so on, then it would be even funnier. So this is a complex rational number, and then everything becomes complex rational numbers. And how do I define it?
It
it's just, so it's a function called promotion rule, promotion underscore rule. It takes two types and it returns one of them.
Okay, very good. Let's quickly do that here. That is that section here.
But we'll also need a convert rule if we want to do this.
If you want to apply it, yes. So we need two parameters. Because we have a quaternion of type T. We need, in the end, of course, to write several promotion rules, because in principle we could convert reals to quaternions as well, and complex numbers to quaternions, and so on. This is getting quite complicated. I don't want to do that here. So, but how do we convert quaternions? The result is a quaternion of, next line, I hope that works, of promote T and U. What?
Shouldn't it be promote rule?
No, it should be promote.
Because promote you give it. Promote rule is what you give types to, and promote is what you give.
Oh yeah, yeah, you're right.
No, it didn't work. Any ideas? It did something like that, but...
I mean, shouldn't you have actually given it quaternions?
Right. I pass types instead of functions. Convert has... Okay, yeah. Since I passed actually the types, now it tries to convert it, but we haven't actually defined the conversion. So... let's just look for the promote rule. Okay, drawstring was too fancy here. Okay, now I don't understand what's going wrong. I think we need to define the conversion operator. I think calling promote rule like that is not a good idea.
We didn't import. It's telling us that we need to import promote rule. But maybe you're right.
Maybe. Yeah, let me restart the kernel. Wait, I probably should have done that here. This one goes away, cell run all. Let's see what happens now. Restart and run all. Now we get the stars. Great.
Strange.
So union, you remember that is the type that has no values. So something that clearly didn't work here. Okay. Let's look at the documentation. I was trying to wing it, but maybe I should not have done that.
Oh.
Oh, you call promote type on the right hand side. Very good. We can easily do that. There you go.
Yay!
So what you learn from that, read the documentation. Don't trust me, they know anything better. Know everything better. Okay, very good. These are quaternions. I'm going to skip subtracting and multiplication because that is just tedious. And getting the output, the print. I was convinced that you can print something after you overload the show function. I don't know. Maybe it fixed itself now. Let's look up there. Whether it works now? I don't think so.
If you look at the help for print and show, it does say they should do different things.
Yeah, I was... Did? Works now. Very good.
Can I add something, Eric, mm-hmm. before you move on to the next thing?
Yep.
If you want to program something like the quaternions generically, one should be careful about using things like 1 over something for division and for inverses and things like that. So there's generic functions like 1 of a value of a type and inv of a value of a type that can be used to correctly implement, for instance, the inverse of a quaternion.
Yes.
Sorry, what was that?
Maybe just type 1 of 3.5 or something.
Okay, sometimes when you implement something, you need the constant 1 or the constant 0. But you want to choose the correct type. For example, if you want to do a calculation with 32-bit integers, when you just write 1, that's a 64-bit integer, so that would automatically convert your 32-bit integer to 64-bit, which you don't want. Or you want to do something in single precision, and then if you write 1.0, it's double precision, and suddenly all the other calculations happen in double precision. So the question is, how do you get simple constants of a particular type? And for example, if you want the constant 0 of a particular type, then you can just write 0 of int, and that gives you 0. Well, that's easy, but...
You can also do 0 of a number.
Of int 32, for example. Or you can do 0 of 3.5.
Yes.
Then you get a real 0. And you can 0 of im is the imaginary constant I. So this should give you... Haha, wow. Yeah. The imaginary constant has the type complex of Boolean. I don't know. They were trying to be a clever there. So complex false false, which of course corresponds to the real number. Anyway, that is fancy. Similarly, there's the constant 1. For example, 1, if I give us input the rational number 1/2, that would be a rational 1. And int of 4, what does that is? Yeah. So instead of writing 1 over something, you can use the function inf, which is the inverse. And if you want to define a division for quaternions, then it may be easiest to define first an inversion. The inverse, and then division is just multiplying with the inverse. Simply, we have if you want to subtract quaternions, you can add a subtraction operation, but you can also just define the unary minus operator and then add the negative and so on.
But you also need, if you want to define the quaternion inverse in a type agnostic way, then you need inv to, because the inverse has 1 over the norm in it, so you need inv.
Yes. So the type of the, so if you have a quaternion of integers and you calculate the inverse, you would get a floating point number. So you get a different result type. It's similar, if you take an integer, square root of an integer, the result would be real. Okay. Anyway, that was that. Let's look at the next homework assignment. What was that? The secant method, function, low, high, and resolution. Okay. This is now, so the previous was defined numbers, parameterized types, and so on. And this is now a function where you have to implement an algorithm. That's if statements, loops, and so on and so forth. I think I...
Can I just ask something about the previous part of it was to do these tests?
Yes.
Right? And I got that you can do like at test and then put an expression.
Yes.
But if you like need to set up some variables and stuff, where should you do that?
What you usually do is you have your own file that only contains the tests. And in this file, you only run that file when you run the tests. And then you just do something in that file. And you can also have it in module. I'm going to talk about that later when I talk about software engineering, because unit tests are obviously important. And this will be one file that contains many of these at test expressions. And then you can have additional expressions there as well. And there are also some examples, of course, in Base Julia. There's a subdirectory test with many, many tests. Good. Let's write the second method. Let's hope it goes a bit faster. So I'm going to open a new Julia notebook. Same type. So what was the input? The input, I think, was a lower and an upper range, and a function and a delta, right? Good. So we have a function, a lower boundary, a higher boundary, and the delta.
Do you want t to be...
Yes, t should probably be a real number. Otherwise, it wouldn't work. Thank you. And notice that for the function f that we call, I didn't put anything there. That's because there are several ways of specifying functions. There's a type function, but there's also a way to specify objects that behave like functions that are not functions that are also callable. So if you want to pass a function, the standard is to not specify anything there. And you get an error if you try to call something that's not a function. So Oof, 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 oof. How do we begin? Let's check. I mean, yeah. The assert statement checks whether a certain condition is true. We expect x low and x high to be an interval. So if it's not an interval, if a lower boundary is higher than the upper boundary, then there's an error. So x low must be...
I don't think you want them equal.
No, why not? Could, yeah, okay, sure. And dx should be positive. And what else do we want to do? Let's calculate a function f low equals f of x low, f low and f high. And we want to bracket the root, so f low and f high must have different signs. Is there a good way to do that?
Sign of their product must be positive, or sorry, negative.
Is that the function?
Yes.
Now, we're leaving out all kinds of special cases because f low or f high could be zero. We should be adding that later on. And that, of course, would be good because then we already found a solution. But we just assume that they're not zero, that all the signs are different.
You can also just assert that the sign is negative because that means that their signs are negative.
If you can multiply them?
Actually, yeah, this assert statement won't work, right? Oh, yeah. That's what I was saying. If you take the product, then...
That's negative. Yeah, sure. But why would I take the product to find out whether two things are different? Okay, and then while x high minus x low is larger than dx. So now I need an estimate. So let's take middle x. And of course, you can just say take the middle, that would be the bisection method, but I want to be more clever. I actually want to look at the function values and draw the line through that. Do you remember that expression on top of your head, how that looks like? Okay, let's fix that on the blackboard. That is f in the middle minus f low f high minus f low x high minus x low, we want to set this to 0, and then we have xm equals i low, which is this expression, it's difficult now. Can you help me? Can you push these things on the other side here?
So
let's just do it. Pardon, did you do it?
Yeah, it's x middle, or sorry, x high minus f high times x high minus x low over f high over f high minus x f low.
Okay, can you say it again?
Sorry. Okay.
X high minus x low divided by f high minus f low?
Yes.
Well, times?
Times f high. And then there needs to be a...
plus x low?
Yes, but the first term should be negative. Yeah.
Something like this?
Yes.
Very good. I'm sure you can look that up somewhere. Then we evaluate f in the middle. And then if sine f low equals sine f mid, then, oh, I was going to put a colon there. There's no then here either, man. Okay, so if the function in the middle has the same values, the same sign as the function on the left, then we move the left boundary. Else we move the right boundary. And that's it, right? Looks good, does it not?
I think so.
Very good. Let's define a function. what function do we use? The square root, right?
You don't actually need to define the function.
Okay, let's call it a of x squared minus 2.
Yeah.
This looks for the square root of 2. And we use the lower boundary 0 and the upper boundary 2. And we want to turn accuracy of 0.1 and, this did not work at all. The solution is between minus 1 and minus 3. Okay, there must be a bug here and there. I'm sure that's at mid here on the right, otherwise it doesn't look symmetric. F mid not defined?
You don't know F mid until you've worked out
X. Ha ha ha, very good, yes. I'm going to write F low then, since F high didn't work. There you go, look at that. And how accurate is that? Why is it so accurate? There's so many digits, this can't be.
Well, probably the straight line was a good guess in that way.
No, not for a square root.
But is that there are many digits, but are they correct?
Yeah, so the result that we're getting is 10 to the minus 16. This is amazingly accurate.
Maybe you just found a new algorithm.
Okay, there's the info statement. And with info, you can output something to the screen. There's also a warn and an error statement, but we're just going to use info, and you're going just to use just output the current interval. And then we also see how many iterations. Look, there's so many iterations. What? Why is x high? And then x high remains at 2? Why does it x high remain at 2?
It should be x layer x high, not x.
Where, here?
No, it's fine.
Here? Okay. So I actually wrote that routine myself. Let me see whether I find it.
Stop.
Yeah, that's the other thing that that surprises me.
Oh, you don't have an absolute value.
Where?
For x high minus x low.
Why?
Oh wait, no, doesn't make sense either. Since yeah, never mind. X high is always greater than x low.
Maybe there's a plus sign here. Nope, there's no plus sign here.
One of these updates isn't working properly, right? Because it just keeps moving
the left boundary,
the
yes.
Up, and then it suddenly just pulls the higher one down, and that's why it stops. Okay? Because if you look at the final x high and x low, they are actually close.
Yes. So that is probably the round off at the end. Of course, if round off errors makes the wrong choice. But, well, let's take the bisection method, right? It's easier to implement,
You're not recalculating F low and F high.
I don't need to. I assign F low and F high from F mid. So if I move X, I also do X low. That should work. Okay, anyway, this is getting boring. Anyway, here we have the bisection method. It works nicely with the bisection method. And you see, I actually have a reasonable accuracy. I said accuracy should be 0.1, and this is 0.1. So this is actually correct then.
What did you just do?
I changed the algorithm here, up here. So I'm using the simple bisection rule now, where it works. Okay, I actually wrote down that algorithm much nicer. I also handled the case where f low, f high is zero, and so on. Many more other statements and tests and so on. I can't find the code at the moment. Oh, wait, no. Maybe I turned it into a package.
Is the problem just that that other x mid was like always an overestimate or always an underestimate? And so it just had to keep moving it until it got, until it actually managed to hit almost the exact right value?
No, that's not the problem because it. Oh! No, that could be. Yes, that is probably indeed the problem that it makes the wrong choice for x middle. Much too conservative, and then it never actually goes to the right point. Okay, but I actually have the solution. I found it here. Can you read this on the screen? Add project folder. So I created a Julia package for it. Where is that now? Here. And if you can read this. The one on the left, is that good? Should I make it larger?
Maybe a bit.
Like this, maybe?
Are we going to read it now?
Okay, yes, let's just go through that. Actually, yeah, let's just look for the expression here. So this is how, this line 27 here, is how Kai calculate the expression. So the expression that we had previously, just a second, that is the one here. You notice that it's not symmetric between upper and lower boundary. And we subtract here f high minus f low and divide by it. And in the end, both f high and f low will get very close to each other because f is going to zero. So we're going to divide by a very small number. And x high minus x low also gets very close to zero because they're also getting close to each other. But this expression becomes progressively more accurate if you want to have a higher high accuracy. And plus, the expression here is not symmetric if you exchange high and low, because we have x low minus, and we multiply by f low here, but not f high. So you can symmetrize the expression, and that is the one I used here. And maybe we should just use that expression here, actually, and see whether it works. Phi mal x low minus f low mal x high divided by f high minus f low. Okay, anyway, the result is correct, so sorry, this is not at all how I expected the homework to proceed. So this is, let's briefly look at the code that I wrote here, because I think that is a nicer solution. First, I define a module, the first line, that contains the method, which means you can import it and use it. I export one function called secant, and then I define an invariant. If you have a complex algorithm like the one that we have here, well, it's not really complex, then it's nice to have an invariant. An invariant is something that needs to be true before a loop, in that case, or before something that is defined iteratively. And then in the loop, you need to maintain the invariant. And then you know the invariant is also true after the loop. And having an invariant explicitly written down makes it easy to test for correctness, because then at runtime, you can just check whether the invariant is actually true. And this is the invariant I'm actually using here. So if here I called it f0, f1 instead of f low and f high. If f0 is 0, so that's if we have found the solution already, then the interval must have a length of 0, x0 and x1 must be identical. And otherwise, either the interval must have a non-zero length, and the function cannot be 0 either on the left nor on the right boundary, and the function must have different signs on the left and on the right boundary. This is actually the thing that we tested in the beginning when the function is called, and this is the invariant. And then in the actual function, there's a lot of error checking, so the actual code is not much more complicated. So first we check the invariance, and then we abort, not with assert, but with an error. The interval is empty. The accuracy dx is not specified positive. We evaluate the function. If the function is zero at the left boundary, then we have found a solution. So I don't actually enter the loop. If the function is zero at the right boundary, we already found something. And now that we know the invariant is actually true because of all the tests we did and all the special cases that we handled, then we can check for the invariant. And then we have the loop here. Let me scroll up now. And in the loop, I check several things. We choose the new point according to the symmetrized rules. Then we check that xm actually is between in, contained in the interval. Who knows what can go wrong here? Evaluate the new function. If the function is zero in the center, then we have found a solution, so we return that solution. Then we shrink the interval, which is the same code as before. We check the sign of the function in the middle, depending on whether it's the same as the sign on the left and the right boundary. We shrink the interval in the exactly same way. After that, the invariant must hold again. We change the interval and the function value, so we call that function again, and by having that not just written in the code, but actually as a function invariant, makes it easier to call it and easier to understand the code. And then there's something else in there. I also ensure that we make progress. So in the beginning of the loop, I calculate the sign of the interval, and afterwards I calculate the new size of the interval, and that must be smaller than the old one, so the interval must be shrinking. And that means the invariant is always true and the interval is shrinking, so we're making progress. Of course, this be real numbers, that doesn't mean that it actually converges, but it's a good thing.
If this has served, if it's not fulfilled, it just sends you a message or that it's not...
It aborts the code. It raises a signal. So assert is mostly used for testing, not actually in the runtime. When you see the distinction I made here in the beginning of the function, if the input values are wrong, I abort with an error, because an error is something that you always want to happen. That's an error in using the function. And assert, there's presumably a way to switch it off. Assert, you want mostly used for debugging. So there are all these assert statements here where these things are checked and where the invariant is checked. And presumably in production, once the function works, you don't want these asserts active anymore. I mean, here you could, but if you want to speed up the code and have it really fast, then you don't need the assert statements anymore. Then you can disable them. And the function is quite a bit longer, but I think I did that sometime last week. And I actually started with invariant and with the assert statements and the error checks, and then it was fairly straightforward to get the routine to be correct. And it was actually, it's not easy to find an invariant that makes sense. If you look at the invariant, the thing down here, the interval must be non-empty and the function must have different signs on the different boundaries. That kind of makes sense. But the special case that the function can also be zero on the left boundary and the interval must have zero lengthen, that is something that I also needed to add to make things work. And actually, we can just run that code. Let's call Julia. And since this is a Julia package that's installed, we can just import it using secant. And then we have it. And then we should be able to call it in the same way here and see what it outputs. And it outputs the same thing. Huh? Let's add the info statement here. Actually, we just copy the info statement. Now let's write a new info looping. Oh no, I use using. Now I have to quit the kernel, restart the kernel, and call it again. And then since it outputs looping every iteration, we see how many iterations it takes. And yeah, it does exactly the same thing. So it's actually working correctly. The second method apparently isn't as good as I thought it would be. Newton's method is better if you want to find a square root.
So why are you getting all the precision again?
The problem is, the function we are solving is a square root. And we look at the here and here. What? No, we want to find a solution here, something. And then we underestimate it. So we're only ever moving the left boundary towards the solution and never the right boundary and getting closer and closer. And what you would happen, assume, is that you move both the left and the right boundary until you have closed. But if you only ever move the left boundary by smaller and smaller steps, and then in the end, something strange happens.
The difference between the left, the right boundary and the moving boundary is always larger than...
Yeah, the difference is really large. And only in the end, when you're really, really close to the zero, then floating point roundoff takes over. And then you're not moving the left boundary, but moving the right boundary. And then, of course, since you're already very close, it makes a very good choice and basically you land on top of the solution.
When I implemented the secant method, I used a different version of it, which doesn't assume bounds. It assumes two guesses. So it starts with two previous guesses and it makes a next guess. And then I started it by using bisection to find the first two guesses. And that conversion like 4 steps.
Okay, so you don't use bounds, but you have guesses.
Yeah.
So you kind of jump around the solution.
Yes.
Oh, right. If you use guesses, then both guesses can be at the same side of the solution. Whereas if you bounds, they need to be on different sides. Okay. Yeah, I wanted to bracket the solution because that guarantees that you have a solution.
I see.
Okay. Good. That was that. The third homework, let's look at that. We can also skip the third homework and go to software engineering instead, if this is getting too boring. Matrix multiplication. Should we do that? Does one of you want to present that? Or should we move on to software engineering?
I have a question that rose up when I was writing the quaternion.
Okay.
I wonder if you may have talked about this before I came. But I had a funny type issue there because I was making my quaternion type a subtype of number.
Mm-hmm.
And I made a small piece that demonstrates exactly this issue if you go to GitHub. And slash mhauru.
M-H-A-U-R-U.
A-U-R-U. Yes. And Julia Cross. And what is it called? Type issue.
Quaternion type issue?
Yeah. So that piece of code. So surprisingly gave me problems. It doesn't give me problems if I uncomment the line that is commented. And I found this kind of annoying.
N can be anything.
So yeah, what it tells me is that
yes.
It complains that it's ambiguous how the typecasting should work, which function should call. Yeah, maybe this
so is let's run it, and...
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Yes. That's unfortunate, but that happens at points in Julia, so that happens also in other cases. That's a generic property of the type system. So sometimes things are ambiguous, and then you need to add more function to create more specific functions to remove
that
ambiguity.
Right, is there no other way around this, because...
No, that happens as well. And it's funny that it happens with bool, but in Julia, bool is a subtype of integer. It's just kind of a one-bit integer, so...
I mean, you can get what you want here by just defining multiplication of quaternions and then having a rule that promotes real numbers to quaternions. Do you see what I mean? Because then that will automatically just get promoted. Like if you do 2 times some quaternion,
Right. Very good. Yes, I mentioned that before. You're defining multiplication for different types. This is not what you would do in Julia. You would define multiplication or for exactly the same type. You would have parameter t and then 2 types of non-type t, and then you would define the promote rules for that. But generically, this problem still happens at some points.
Okay.
So you can't go around that. And defining special cases like that, that you often have to do that. And it also happened to me with bool and so on.
Okay.
Let's move on to software engineering and then GitHub and packages and so on. We are going to write a program that outputs hello world. And we're going to do a really fancy schmancy. We're going to define a module and a GitHub repository and automated testing and coverage line number counting and so on and so forth. And I'm going to do it online, and let's see how that works. I tested it twice earlier, so it should work, but who knows whether it works or doesn't. So I'm going to use the Julia interpreter. Can you read what's there at the bottom? Let me just move it up a bit. So you know the package system? You have packages, and if you run package update, it updates the list of packages that exist. There are packages that are kind of semi-officially distributed with Julia, and you can also install packages by simply pointing Julia to the URL of a GitHub repository somewhere. So of course, the package we are going to write is not going to be officially associated with Julia. So if you want to look at my Hello World program, you're going to have to use the URL github.com/hello-world. I was hoping this was going to be a bit faster, but let system chug along. This package system with PKG, you can also easily create packages, generate packages, and then it creates a shell, a skeleton of a package. And that contains 5 or 10 interesting files. Now I'm just going to stop that here. This is. There you go. Clang is a large packet that's with username for, incredible. No, stop. Okay, so if you want to generate a package, the function is package generate. If you just have package and hit the tab key, then it lists all the things you can do in a package, and one of them is generate. And then we choose a name for the package, which is Hello World. And you also need to choose a license for the package as the second argument. It knows two licenses, BSD and MAT. And here, this is the, I think, the modified two-clause BSD license. You can, of course, change it later. The license is just a text file that's copied into the package. So it created all these files. And now let's go and look at the package. So there's each package has a directory, which is, in this case, in my home directory, Hello World. So let's cd into this directory. And let's look at there. So if you hit semicolon, then you can enter shell commands here. So I'm doing that. And then you see all the files here. I meant to do ll because there are dot files here. You see there's a .git file because it created the package. It also created a Git repository and already made a first commit importing that skeleton. There's a git ignore and there's a license. Let's just look at the license. No, that's not that. There's a readme. That's also boring. Let's go to the source directory. Does that work? Yeah. So the open, whatever. So I'm just going to open an editor in the directory. This is just the magic incantation you do this on OS 10. You can also do other things. So I'm using Atom as an editor. So I'm adding a new project folder. I'm just telling Atom where this package is located. So then we can you read that on the left? It's a bit small on the top here. Very good. So there's a, since I called the package Hello World, Julia created a file, a module called Hello World, and our package code goes in here. So let's write our Hello World function. We want to export the function Hello. So let's define it. Function Hello, and it returns Hello World. And that's it. And in Julia here, I can type git status. And I see that there's one file modified, Hello World. The error message up here means that the upstream repository in GitHub does not yet exist. I'm going to create that manually later. So I'm going to commit the changes here, which is git add source. Git commit create hello world. Very good. So now I have a bit of source code in here. Now I'm going to go to GitHub and create the repository there. What happened here? No, not interesting. GitHub net plus create a new repository. I'm going to call it helloworld.gl.jl. It's customary that all repositories that contain Julia code have a .jl suffix. I do not know why people don't do it with other languages, but in Julia people do it that way, and that's also what the system expects. And of course the description is hello world. I'm going to keep it public because I don't want to pay for a private repository. I'm not going to initialize the repository because it's already initialized. I mean, already have a repository. going to create it. And now I'm going to push my changes to this repository. Did that work? Wow, that would have been cool. Let's reload the GitHub page here. And it pushed the repository, these files there. Friend, this is the hello world here, down here, for example. Let's just, well, yes. And what this also generated, let's look at the files here. There is a .travis.yaml file. Travis is a build service. It's a service that runs in the cloud that can download arbitrary code. It builds the code. It runs the code. It runs tests for the code. And then it tests whether the checks succeed. And it does that after every commit to, say, a GitHub repository. And it's really convenient to do that because that means you don't have to do that manually. And if one of your collaborators pushes something to the GitHub repository, you always know whether your code is running correctly or not. For a homework or something, that's maybe not interesting. But if you work on something for your research, then it's nice to have a set of tests that are automatically run. And if your GitHub is open source, if it's publicly available, this Travis service is free of charge. The only limit is that you can't, I mean, the building and so on, testing can't take then more than 10 or 15 minutes per repository. So this is already set up. Build status, the icon is broken at the moment because Travis does not know yet anything about our system, but we can go here. And this, sorry. Hello. Yes, here we go. This goes to Travis. The first time, CI means continuous integration. That's the continuous testing. The first time to go to Travis, you have to create an account there. Same as for GitHub. And you have to tell Travis about your GitHub account, and you have to allow Travis to check out the code, get read-only access to the GitHub account. I did that. You have to do that as well. But since I already did that, I'm not going to repeat that here. A larger screen. Then my repositories, I need to find it here. What? Oh no, gee. Now I'm going to find the repository that I just created on GitHub and tell Travis that it should run tests for that as well. Sorry. Okay, yeah, you have to press the sync button. Sync means that Travis looks at GitHub again, at all the repositories that I have there, because I just have one, it didn't look at it. Syncing from GitHub. And then it lists down here all the repositories I have on GitHub, and there should be one new one. Do you see it?
Yeah, it was up there. Here,
that's the new one. The slider is off, I can switch it on. And that means now Travis will automatically build the Hello World directory, the Hello World project. I need to make a change to the project so that Travis actually will do that. So I make a trivial change to the project. Go hello world. You can actually edit files in GitHub. I go to the README. I edit it. And I just add a space here between hello and world. Commit the changes. And let's look at the repository here. What was the wrong one? Sorry. Is it this one here? Yes. Now what? These are the settings. Oh, I don't want the settings here. This is how it looks like. This colors here can be red, green, or yellow. Red if the build fails, green if it has succeeded, and yellow if it's currently building. So it's currently building, downloading the tests, building and running it four times for different versions of Julia on Linux and on OS X. You see here, that's the released version of Julia, and that's the nightly version of Julia, what's going to be Julia 0.5. I don't actually want that, so we can switch that off. And the .travis.yaml file, Julia release a nightly, I'm just going to delete the line nightly. So for the next test, it will only run that with the released version of Julia. And this should not take too long. In a few seconds, the test should all have succeeded.
Eric.
Yep.
In the meantime, I didn't understand how the local packaging system made the connection between your Git repository and the GitHub repository. Just magically seemed to work.
Yes, so what the package system does is, of course, everything only local.
Yeah.
It uses Git to create a local repository, and then it made a first commit with everything, and then it created pointer to a remote, to a non-existing remote directory on GitHub.
And based on the name of the package? Or?
Yes, based on the name of the package.
And
it
the
just
local Git user? Or?
And the Git user, yes. Actually, in Git, Git knows my username on GitHub because I configured Git that way.
Okay.
There are a few tricks like that you have to do only once when you use it for the first time. And I think if you read the corresponding package development section in the Julia manual, that should all be clear.
Okay.
And then I just need to create the respective repository on GitHub. And that's that. And when you go to Travis, the first time you have to point it to the repository on GitHub, and you have to create a token on GitHub and tell Travis on the token so that they can talk to each other and so on. So the first time it was 10 minutes of work. But later on, you just enable the new repository. And now it should be ready, and you need to see all the check marks. So everything is actually fine. The code builds just fine. Of course, that's not surprising. Now, in the auto-generated the package has a certain structure. There are all these files here, and there's a source directory and the test directory. Source contains all the source code. There's only one file, which is the Hello World file that we just looked at. Sorry, that is a bit small here, that, which is this one here, one function Hello World. And the tests, of course, are at the moment actually empty. The test is one file that runs all the tests. In that file, in the beginning, you import the module Hello World, the one we're testing, using base.test. You have to import that every time you run self-tests, and then it runs one test. It checks whether one is equal to one. That should succeed, and it actually does. Now let's write our own test here. So for example, add test starts with hello, right? So it starts with is a function that checks whether one string starts with another string. Hello is the function that we define. I'm going to call it. It returns hello world. And I check whether that actually begins with hello. Now, that's one of the correctness properties I want of my hello world program, that it begins outputting something that begins with hello. Now, let's make the changes here. I modified the Travis so that it only runs with the released version of Julia. So I'm going to commit the changes. Travis git commit add tests git minus m git push. What? Yeah, I made a change on GitHub in the web browser, adding the README. I need to pull that. Then I can push. And then if I watch here, this is now doing build one. In a few seconds, it should switch over to building build number two. Mm. Come on, why, what? Yeah, it's a demonstration effect. I think there you go. And you see now it builds only two things. There's a nice penguin here, and there's a nice apple here for Linux and for macOS. And there's one file in here that we haven't talked about called appware.yaml. This is the Travis equivalent for a different service called appware. Appware does Windows builds, not Linux and macOS builds. By default, it does four builds again with version 4.0 of Julia for 32 and 64-bit Windows, and the latest version, which is going to be version 0.5. And the things down here are slightly more complicated for appware than for Travis, but it's the same thing. So if I go to appware and enable things in the same way I did for Travis, then it would also do Windows tests there automatically. I'm not going to do that here, but it's rather easy to do and to set up. Okay, if we look at the Travis file, then you see you can uncomment the following lines. They are currently commented out because that's all the default. Let me just uncomment them. Then you see what Travis actually does. So what Travis does, it gives you a virtual machine that boots to a pristine system that has basically just basic Ubuntu installed. Language Julia. Julia is actually natively supported by Travis. It installs the Julia version that you specified here via operating system and release. Then in its script, it does some Git magic that I don't really care about. And then it runs this code here, Julia minus E, it runs Julia, executes that command. It clones a package with a name that depends on the current directory. It runs in Hello World, so it's going to clone the Hello World package. then it's going to build the hello world package. There's nothing to build because Julia is uninterpreted. That happens very quickly. Then it tests, package tests the hello world package, and coverage equals 2, meaning it also checks what lines are executed during testing. It keeps the statistics internally, which lines are executed and which not. So if you have a test system, then the question is what fraction of your code is actually tested and what you left out. Otherwise, it could be a huge function that you actually forgot to test. So it keeps this coverage and it stores that information locally, but it doesn't push it anywhere, so you can't look at the information. However, there's a service for that called CoverRoles that you can use. So this is the last thing regarding software engineering I wanted to show. This is this magic line that you need to add, which unfortunately is not added automatically. So you add that to your Travis script. Ah, discretizations, that's wrong. That should be hello world. So after success, if the self-test is executed, it runs these things, and then it runs Julia, it goes in the directory hello world, it adds the coverage package and use it to submit to CoverRoles. CoverRoles is the name of that service. Process folder means all the test results or the coverage results from the local folder to look at. So let's go to CoverRoles. CoverRoles, oh, no. Yeah. Here, test coverage and history statistics. Of course, you need to create an account on CoverRoles, and you have to tell CoverRoles that it can access your GitHub and your Travis accounts, need to tokens and so on, which you have to do only one. But let's do that. This is how I tested it earlier at a repos. So I'm going to add the new Hello World repository. There, you need to sync the repository, same as GitHub, that it looks for new repositories that I just created. And then add repository, add pro means I get professional support to my account there and I pay money, which I don't want to do. And I have a Hello World program here. I switch it on. Now I need to make another change and then it should, CoverRoles should pick it up. So I push a change to the GitHub repository. This is the README. There's a nice icon there, built passing, that was there by default. That means that the Travis tests are succeeding. Let's look at Travis here. That was test number 2. I just pushed a change and a few changes. Travis should begin to test something again, to test the next change. Yeah, that's going to be a minute. And after this test is done, Travis will run the corresponding test code that pushes the changes from the Travis system to CoverRoles. And there we can then look at the coverage, how many of the lines of code in our Hello World module are actually tested by the test. And the nice thing is that the service is all free for open source projects and for closed source projects, you pay for it. And I think this is the future of software engineering. I mean, there's a bit of clicky pointy setting up these things. But if you have a non-trivial project or work on the group or something, then this is really easy to do because you need to do that once per project. And in the end, the advantages from that are enormous and you don't need to maintain any infrastructure yourself.
Is it going to rerun tests even though, okay?
Yes.
Even though we didn't change any of the source files?
Yes, it doesn't look at that. So what Travis does, it gets a new virtual machine, I mean, freshly installed Ubuntu, download the complete source code and build it from start. So there's nothing in there. And last time it took 30 seconds or something. So most of the time is probably spent downloading and installing Julia, which of course is part of the tests since you start with an empty virtual machine. You can actually see what happens if you click on this one here. You see the screen output and you can follow the log file. Now it's installing some packages there. We're already there. Yeah, now it's already. Oh yeah, it's installing coverage, the Julia package coverage, and then it should be pushing the changes to coverage soon. So it ran the tests already. Mm. Yeah, let's look at the output of the Linux process, should be the same thing. Yeah, jumping around badly. I think my web browser window is too small for that. Let's look at the Hello World project here. Details. So these are just the instructions on coveralls, how to make it work for Hello World. I'm just going to wait here until Travis has finished building it, which should take another 30 seconds. And then that page should change. Yeah, 2 minutes. Let's follow the log file so that at least something is going on.
Can you say again what this add test statement exactly does in this?
Okay, yeah, no. I was so concentrating on GitHub and Travis and coveralls that I didn't actually say what this actually does. Okay, yeah. So Julia has a self-test system built in. There is add test. There are a few other things like that where you can test whether something, not whether something works, but whether something fails. You can test for exceptions, or you can test for approximate equality, your floating point numbers or something. But a test is a macro and expects a function, a command, something that runs there. And that thing is supposed to return a Boolean, namely true. And if it's true, the test succeeds. And if it's false, the test counts as failed. And in the end, it keeps certain statistics about how many tests succeeded and how many tests failed. And you can run it manually, but if you have a package and the system set up, then you can also run these tests manually. I wanted to do that. So this runs all the tests for the Hello World package and just says all the tests passed. You can also change it to have a test that actually fails. Only one L, and then you get error message. And it says you exactly, there's a test that failed, and this is the test that failed, hello, and it also gives you the line number. Where is the line number? If you have in expression starting on line 4, it's the last line of that, because that's line 4 of the test here.
So it means an add test statement does only make sense in this test directory. Why can you also put
it? You can also have it in other places, but by default, it does nothing. So you can also mix a test statement into a regular module. And if you just run the module, it will not do anything. But if you then test it, it will do something. Is that true?
No,
that's not true. It runs all the time. No, I was wrong. Sorry. I mixed it up with Google Test, a different framework. Sorry, I'm getting confused here.
If you run at test 1 equals equals 0, it will complain.
Yeah, it's similar to assert in that respect.
Yeah, okay, that's fine.
But the difference is that assert throws an exception and does not continue, whereas test would continue. The idea is you have 100 tests, and then it keep track of which failed and which succeed. And even if one fails, you continue to look at the other tests. Good. This is this. All the tests succeeded. Let's go back to coveralls, and you should see some statistics here finally. So here we get 100% coverage, build number 3. Let's look at the result of build number 3. We have two test results because we ran it on Linux and OS X. Let's look at one of them. And let's look at the file Hello World. And then this gives you the source file here. And this is basically not readable. It's nicely pink. And there are green lines and red lines. Pink lines are lines that are not executable. Red or green are executable ones. The green ones have been tested. The red ones have not been tested. Here, this package contains only one executable line, and it was actually tested twice, once. Should have been tested twice, because the tests run for both Linux and OS X. And that means it's green, and since there's one executable line and we tested it, we have 100% coverage. In a real package, you can't get to 100%. Probably somewhere above 90% is really difficult. Because in real code, you all have checks for error conditions or something, and you don't want to recreate all the error conditions just for testing. And yeah, let's go a bit back here, because there's another badge available. Badges are very important. So there is a Markdown badge, which I'm going to copy here. I'm going to go to my Hello World repository. This is the README file. I'm going to add the badge here and commit the change. And then you'll see we have a Hello World project. The build is passing and we have 100% coverage. And if the build is not passing, then this turns red. And depending on how much coverage you have there, this becomes yellow or red if you didn't write enough tests. Okay. Very good. I've walked you through all of this. And if you want to work on a real world Julia program, I recommend that you try this out at one time. And I mean, beginning setting up all the accounts and the different things and making that work, that probably takes you an hour or two, but you have to do that only once in your life. So it's quite convenient to do that. Okay, so this is Hello World tests. What I also wanted to talk is about performance and measuring performance in Julia, but it's by 5:30 and you're getting a bit tired, so we can also do that next time. Depending on what you want. Yes, no, maybe?
I'm missing a discussion from the workshop. I mean, I could do it now, but if you're going to continue, I'll stay.
Okay. No, okay. I think you're tired out. So
okay.
I'm going to end it now and see you next week with a discussion about performance.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.